Good afternoon, brothers and sisters.
Afternoon, Shifu.
Good afternoon, Shifu.
How are you all today? So we are back online. So just now kalang kabut. I now repeated one line. I was like, eh? What happened to Ujupatipan no Bhagavato? Yeah, that's the thing. When we do something repetitively over time, then we get used to it. when there's a shift, sometimes okay, let's see. So usually we will, in the live class, we will actually ask everybody, ask whether there's anybody newer. So let me see. Today is our first time having the Zoom and Facebook concurrently for the SGC as well. So should we ask? Let me see. There are still some number of you with your video off. Can we get Xiu Jun, Esther, Li Hui, Quek, Jess, and Gek Sing to turn on the webcam? Yeah, Xiu Quen. Okay, let's see who is new. Anybody who is new to SGC? I'm getting confused because we have the daily sitting, so it looks exactly the same. So I don't know who is new anymore. I think Kia Kim looks newer. Tay Kia Kim, are you new? Your mic is off.
Yeah.
So how do you get?
I'm quite new to Zoom.
Sorry.
We ask the phone. Ask the phone. Can you hear me?
Can.
The phone, can you hear me?
Yes, yes.
I'm quite new to the Zoom. Hello, so me.
Yes, yes, I can hear you. Can you hear me?
Yeah, I get to know through Sai Kiang.
Oh, Sai Kiang, very.
Yeah, so she was
welcome,
telling
welcome.
Me to her link. So I say, okay, available. Many years ago, I ever take your Heart Sutra course. Many years ago.
Many years ago.
Yeah.
Where was that?
Maybe 8 years.
Oh, wow.
Maybe 8 years.
Wow.
But so I just see the title of the topic that I'm very interested. That's why I joined.
Wow, then I sweat.
Okay, thank you, Sir Fu.
Okay, welcome. Let's see, who else is new? Xiu Quen, I think, did you attend the SGC Live? Xiu Jian, Xiu Quen.
Not for the live, but ever go to SG that site, library.
Oh, I see. So how did you get to know about the Zoom today?
From the website on the Facebook then.
Okay. Welcome. Let me see, who else? The rest, I don't know. Who else haven't introduced before? Raise your hand. Otherwise, I will assume you all attended before. Otherwise, our class cannot finish. So today's topic, as Kia Kim shared, she says that when she see the topic, she's very interested. So this make me sweat. Because as I remarked to some students, this is again thanks to our volunteer Sai Kiang. She always come out with very big topics. Yeah, when I say big topics, what do I mean? I mean the topic itself covers it's very massive. So Abhidhamma. Today's topic is on Abhidhamma. If you go around looking at the various courses in Singapore on Abhidhamma, it's usually like in terms of years, at least 1 year, 2 years, or 3 years. Usually, if you have a one talk, then it's just an overview. It's just an introduction kind of talk. So I hope you all are mentally prepared. This is a level 100 talk, not even 200. So if you are thinking, oh, I attended Abhidhamma class before, I want to come and learn more, this is more like an overview. So what is Abhidhamma? I prepared some information. Then I prepared halfway, then I realized if I continue in that direction, I will, again, like last week, the 10 qualities, I realized that if I continue in the direction I was on, I will have too many pages. So I decided, okay, I'll just give overview of some things, and then I will share with you the standard 7 books in the Pali tradition, in the Theravadan tradition, they have 7 books. And even then, it's just an overview. And today, perhaps I will share with you my own encounter with what is Abhidhamma. In the lineage I was trained in, the approach we take in looking at the Abhidhamma text or the commentaries. And perhaps that can serve as a guide for all of you on how you can look at Abhidhamma. Okay? So let me share the screen. Let me share the screen. Okay. So can you all see the screen? So the word Abhidhamma shouldn't be foreign to most of us. So it is, it comprises two parts. One is Abhi, the other one is Dharma. I've written down Abhi Dharma and Abhidhamma. So one is in Sanskrit, one is in Pali. They fundamentally mean the same thing. Yeah. So the word Abhi has a few meanings. The common ones is higher or superior. I've seen some translations where they translate as beyond. Yeah. So that's to refer that this set of texts, this set of teachings refer to the higher Dharma. And Dharma here can refer to the Buddha's teaching. Yeah. But in some texts it says that it's actually talking about the phenomena. Yeah. So the teachings on the higher teachings on about phenomena, you can say that. In the Chinese tradition, we transliterate as Abhidhammo, or Abhidhan, or Bhidhan. So all this refers to the same thing, Abhidhamma. And in the so in terms of the Abhidhamma, then it falls under the Tripitaka, isn't it? The Tripitaka, the what we call the tree basket. Tripitaka. So the tree baskets. Let me just. So the three baskets will refer to Sutta Pitaka, Vinaya Pitaka, and Abhidhamma Pitaka, right? So where did the Abhidhamma come from? I'm going to touch a bit about the question that Sakyam posed. in terms of who wrote the Abhidhamma, yeah, where did it come from, and like what is the source of it. We know that in all the traditions, it is widely agreed that the first two Pitaka, the Vinaya and the what do you call that, the Sutta Pitaka, it stems from the first council where Venerable Mahakashapa convened the first council with 500 arahants, Venerable Upali reciting the Vinaya Pitaka, and then Venerable Ananda reciting the suttas, right? So most would agree that the Abhidhamma wasn't readily recited at that point in time. But if you look at various texts on Abhidhamma, there are different understanding of where it comes from. Some would say that the Buddha actually formulated the full teachings in the first 4 weeks after enlightenment, yeah. And that the essence of what is found in Abhidhamma is already taught, yeah, and found in the suttas, yeah. But at the same time, if you look at the Abhidhamma itself, it does contain further elaboration of certain key concepts found in the suttas. The key concepts are found in the suttas, but the elaborations are not. So by and large, across most traditions, we would agree that the Abhidhamma is a collection of analysis, compilation of the teachings, yeah, and organizing them into certain structures. Yeah. So we will look at the different texts and then also perhaps look at a bit of the structures that is commonly found in the various traditions of Abhidhamma. Well, you will also find that if you search online, whether in terms of the internet or in various classes, right? In the Theravadan tradition, there is the standard seven books Abhidhamma. But beyond that, there are also commentaries, such as the famous Visuddhimagga. But beyond Visuddhimagga by Venerable Buddha Ghosa, there are also other commentaries. So here I've listed out like Ta Zi Di Lun. It is a commentary on the Mahaprajna Paramita Sutra. So this belongs to the Madhyamika school, the Prajna series. The next one, Chen Shi Lun, also under the Prajna school. Yeah. So both expounds and further elaborate the principles found in the emptiness school. So the other ones I've listed down here, Yu Qie Si Di Lun, Yugachara Bhumi Sastra, Siddha Chen Lun, Mahayana Samgraha, Chen Wei Si Lun, basically the establishment of Yogacara or the consciousness only school, and then the Da Chen Bai Fa Ming Men Lun, basically a kind of like a subtext equivalent to the Dhamma Sanghani that we'll go through later. So by and large, in the Chinese Mahayana tradition, we see this all the commentaries as further explanation of the teachings found in the suttas. But very interestingly, if you look at most of the Theravada texts on the commentary on the Abhidhamma, you'll find this very interesting narrative, which is that besides a notion that the Abhidhamma was already formulated by the Buddha, yeah, within the first 4 weeks of his enlightenment, it is also said that at some point the Buddha actually went up to Tavantisa's heaven and gave teachings to the heavenly beings there, including his mother who has passed away. Yeah, and that every day he would come down and give summary teachings to Venerable Sariputra, who in turn gave the teachings to Venerable Ananda. Yeah. And so how should I put it? There is this tradition, yeah, that is recognized in the Theravada lineage, that position the authorship of the Abhidhamma in this way. But by and large, when you look at the text, right, sutras tend to be narratives. Yeah, narratives means that there's usually like a prelude of where, what happened, who, what, when, why, how. Yeah. And then there's usually in the form of a kind of like a dialogue, an exchange. Someone asking question and then the Buddha replying, or between either the Buddha's disciples and other ascetics. Yeah. But in the Abhidhamma, it is almost like a syllabus, right? Yeah. It's almost like a reference manual. This much we can see that in present day, when you look at all the different Abhidhamma texts from different lineages, that is a structure. Yeah. What's also interesting is that in the Chinese Mahayana tradition, they actually retain a good number of Abhidhamma texts from different lineages, yeah, including from the Srivastivadin, yeah, the Dhammagupta, Vaibhashika, and so on and so forth, yeah. The Theravadan lineage tend to retain only one particular version, yeah. That over the past few centuries, there are attempts to make the Abhidhamma more accessible as well. So if you look at some of the forward, then they talk about how at some point the Abhidhamma was seen to be too abstract. So there are sub-commentaries written, so to explain. Then at some point they find that the sub-commentaries are too complicated. So then there are those who write summaries of it. Yeah, so this expansion and contraction happened over the centuries. So with that, I'm going to just give you all a brief overview of the Abhidhamma as seen inside the Theravadan tradition. So as I mentioned, there are seven books. And this is found online. You can actually find this information online. The access to insight. So, hang on. I think I should string this so that you all can see it clearer. So the first book is on Dhamma Sanghani. Yeah. So it basically lists out all the different phenomena. Yeah. And where is it? Hang on. Just now, I was just referring to one book. Give me a second. Yeah. So the first book on Dhamma Sanghani lays out the various phenomena, what we also call Dhamma. Yeah. Dhamma or Dhamma is referring to phenomena. Yeah. As we know, Dhamma has three meanings. Phenomena, that means things, yeah, not just physical things, but mental, physical things. And then the second is the support, the principles that defines them. And the third is Buddha Dhamma, right? So here, Dhamma Sanghani refers to phenomena. And inside this listing is, it breaks down into the mental concomitants, the different mental states, yeah, physical states, and the unconditioned. So in this other text, which I highlighted here, the Da Cheng Bai Fa Ming Wen Wen, right? So this one, this is a text on the Bai Fa, which I used in the past to conduct the class. So this book itself is almost like an equivalent to the Dhamma Sanghani. It lists out all the different phenomena, grouping it into five broad categories. Yeah, Xing Shuo. So the 心不相应心法, 色法, 心不相应心法, then 无为法. So mind, mental concomitants. Then you have the form, and then the condition phenomena that is not linked to mind or body, yeah, not directly anyway. And then the last one is the unconditioned phenomena, yeah, totaling 100. You'll find that whether you look at this particular text or the Abhidhamma, Theravada Abhidhamma, or you look at Shravastivadin Abhidhamma, the way they classify the phenomena are almost never 100% one-to-one. There's a lot of similarities. There's some overlap, some differences. Yeah. So a bit about how I approach these teachings is, initially, when you go through the Abhidhamma, if you were to go through just one particular school, in a way, it's easier because then you just follow this framework. Yeah. But if you do that, then it's easy to then draw the conclusion, this is the only way to look at the world. But for any of you who have learned the Abhidhamma from any of the tradition, let me ask you a simple question. In terms of the mental concomitants, the Chittaseka, right? It does go through a lot of fine detail, right? But if you compare this with modern definition of emotions, which one do you think is more detailed? Yeah, which one do you think is more detailed? I personally find that the modern definition of mental states or emotional states is more detailed. More detailed doesn't mean it's more right or wrong. It just means that they draw finer delineation. Yeah. So, and as I said, it doesn't make it more right or wrong. It just means that the classification is different. Yeah. So what's the implication? The implication is, I would say, don't get too caught up with specific classification, although it's helpful to know them. But in all the different traditions, the classification in Buddhism always group them under wholesome or unwholesome, yeah, because it serves a purpose. It's not meant to be just an empirical reference manual just for the sake of reference manual. Yeah, it's just like if you buy an equipment and it comes with a reference manual, it's not just good to know information, but it's meant to help you repair the equipment. So similarly, you can look at Abhidhamma as a reference manual to our existence for us to repair the equipment. Yeah, repair what equipment? When do we need to repair the equipment? When you find that the mental states that arises fall under the unwholesome states, yeah, the unwholesome ones. If it's the wholesome one, then you should also know how they arise. Yeah. So whether wholesome or unwholesome, to know how these states arises. Yeah. And by knowing this, then you can nurture the growth of wholesome states, reduce the unwholesome states, wholesome states that has arisen to help it to grow, unwholesome states that has not arisen to prevent it from growing. So in this way, then, this is a very direct usage of the Abhidhamma to help us do what? Practice the Noble Eightfold Path. Yeah, can you all see that link? Yeah. Whereas if you don't see this, then if you end up getting caught with all the terms, you just look at this, there are 52 mental factors, yeah, and 89 different possible chittas. And inside this text, this thin text, this is very thin, 100 altogether, all the different classification. So if you were to learn thinking that, oh, it's like when we study in school, memorize everything, then I personally find that approach will help you to clear exams. If you are taking a diploma course or a bachelor's course, you should maybe go and memorize, because that's the only way they test you, right? Yeah. But if you want to use it as part of your course of spiritual practice, then you want to map what you have learned to what you are going through. Yeah. Or another way to look at it is to map what you have gone through, what you are going through with what is taught. And bear in mind that it is seldom one-to-one. As I mentioned in many classes, even the fundamental defilements like greed, hatred, delusion, most of the time in our day-to-day, we don't specifically think of our own mental states as greed, hatred, delusion, right? We may feel frustrated, but we seldom think that we are full of hatred, right? We may want more of of a certain food or the company of a certain person, yeah, or watch more one more episode of Netflix, right? But we rarely think of ourselves as greedy, yeah, right? We seldom think of ourselves as having, wow, I have craving for Netflix. Yeah, I mean, sometimes we do use that word, right? But oftentimes it's actually a form of it. Yeah. So similarly for the Dhamma Sanghani within the Abhidhamma. So this is one important part. And that's why when I give the teaching on the Da Cheng Bai Fa Ming Wen Lun, yeah, which is, as I said, the equivalent for Dhamma Sanghani, a huge part of the class was about an exploration into how students see the teachings in their life. And then in the process, I will share with them exercises for them to try it out, yeah, and see whether they are able to observe these mental states and what they can do about them. Oh. So this is one part of it. Yeah, then the next one you have Vibhanga. Yeah, Vibhanga, the term itself, oftentimes you find inside the sutta. Vibhanga itself is more or less translated as analysis. Yeah, so like in the Pali Canon, you have Marga Vibhanga, Shatra Vibhanga, and so on and so forth. So here is more further analysis of it. I'll just go through some of the text and share with you what I can, whatever I can remember as I've gone through them in the like way back in US. So then next you have the Dhatu Kata, referring to the different elements. You know? Then you have Pugala Panyati. So here, this part is interesting. This part talking about the different individuals, yeah, the different categories of individuals. So take this for example. This can be interesting for practitioners also, yeah, to examine which category do you belong to. But in the Buddhist approach, don't think of that as a fixed entity, okay? Yeah. So it is very similar to in the corporate world, we have profiling, right? Yeah. We have the behavior. Like you answer a series of like 40 questions or what, then they tell you the four quadrants and then they plot it out, right? Then they draw a map and they tell you you are more towards the what visionary or possessive, are you the more aggressive one or so and so forth. Yeah. So if you think about it, this is quite interesting because this text dates back to 2,000 years ago. Yeah. So yeah, so HR personality profiling can be found in Abhidhamma. Yeah, but the angle is of course quite different. The angle talk about the different inclinations. Yeah, whether this person is inclining towards this kind of traits or that kind of traits, and then correspondingly, what kind of practices and so on and so forth. Oh. Katabatu is, in my impression, besides Dhamma Sanghani, Katabatu is by far the one that leaves a strong impression. So I'm going to leave it for last, okay? Next, Yamaka, a list of all the different pairs. And the last one, Revelations, talking about dependent origination, yeah, Pachayas, all the different conditions, conditional arising and stuff. You know? But Katavatu, This book is very interesting. If you have a chance, regardless of whether you subscribe to the Theravada Abhidhamma or whichever tradition you follow, this book is interesting. Yeah. Why? Because it actually talks about how way back the different schools within Buddhism, how they look at different concepts, different themes and teachings found in Buddhism. For example, sometimes students may ask, what's the difference between Buddha and the Arhant? So some of these themes are actually explored in Kathabatu, points of controversy. Yeah. From what I can remember, this thing about Arhant, right? So they had question mark about, like today, it is almost like a foregone knowledge that certain traditions look at Buddha quite differently from Arhant. Whereas typically in the Theravadan tradition, then we say that, oh, Buddha is also Arhant, no difference. But yet at the same time, you look at Pali Canon, quite clearly the Buddha explicitly stated that there are certain things that the Buddha can do that Arhants are not able to do. Yeah, that there are distinctions, right? But at the same time, he also declared himself as an Arhant. He's also declared as an Arhant. So today we may feel like, oh, it's just a Mahayana thing, no, that established Buddha quite differently. But way back, before what we usually agree to be the formal arising of something called Mahayana, in the time of the 18 schools, there were already differing views or question marks starting to arise about what constitutes an Arahant. So, for example, certain things happen, yeah, after the Buddha passed away. When things happened during the Buddha's time, they could easily refer to the Buddha and then get the Buddha to clarify and explain. So then the Buddha would clarify, okay, this person is already an Arahant. Yeah. Although, like for example, the account of the monk who walked, yeah, did walking meditation and then step on insects and kill insects. So the other monks were like, hey, is that actually, how did that happen, you know? So the Buddha declared him as being faultless. Yeah, he was blind, and but he has attained Arahanthood. Yeah, so he couldn't have killed out of the defilements. Yeah, there are many other such suttas where the Buddha was there to clarify, yeah, to basically serve as an abiter to the question marks. But after the Buddha passed away, then how? Yeah, how? So what happened? So there were some incidences that seem to imply that that person is not an Arahant. Yeah, that by right, based on past records, you know, past cases, Arahants don't do such things, ma. Yeah. So then people started having questions. And it's not just one case or two cases, but a few different cases. And so from there, different schools approach it differently. And some schools say, in that case, these individuals are no longer Arahant or couldn't have been Arahant to begin with. Yeah, that means some say something that they are not Arahant. That's something that they have to be Arahant. Yeah, so it means that there's something else. And yet there are those who say, oh, then they belong to a group of Arahant that can retrograde. Yeah, that can, no, this is serious. You go ahead and take a look inside the Kathabatu. Yeah, so it's quite interesting. Yeah, so because of incidences that happen. So then there's all these question marks, including the question of, I think time was put to question also. Yeah, what is time? A whole series of different concepts, Nibbana, what is Nibbana, and so on. Yeah. Among them, let me see if I can give you a bit of some of the overview. So among them, right, just now we talk about Dharma, so all the phenomena. Then among them, there's also a further concept of whether things exist or not. Yeah. whether things exist or not. So, of course, this question itself seems strange, right? Why would there be a question of whether things exist? Yeah. Does the monitor in front of you exist? Does the screen in front of you exist? So, of course, the answer should be yes, right? So, there are questions about how they exist. You say it exists. So, how does it exist? Does it truly exist independently? And when you say it exists, is it permanently existing? And of course, today is again seem to be a foregone knowledge. Yeah. So we say conditioned phenomena is impermanent. Yeah. Yeah. So we say now the monitor is in front of you. So we say it exists. So how about the monitor you had in the past? Does it exist? And how about a monitor that you're going to buy in the future? Does it exist? Of course, you can say, yeah, of course it exists. It's inside a shopping mall. Yeah. So the some of these questions become somewhat philosophical. Yeah. And it's not simply about, oh, because it's in a shopping mall. If it's so simple, they wouldn't be writing a treatise about it. Yeah. It has to do with the question of past, future, and present. Does the past exist or not exist? Does the future exist or not exist? Yeah. So there are those, when you go through the text, not just this part, but the whole Abhidhamma, and not just the Theravadan tradition, but also from the other texts that I mentioned, there are many who look at them and say, hey, this is like a counterpart to what the Western world consider as philosophy, right? Looking at the nature of the world, the reality that we exist in. Yeah, the reality that we exist in. So then another concept is what we call swabhava, yeah. 自信, Chinese we call it 自信. Whether something has inherent nature or not. And it's linked to the part that just now I talked about, whether things all exist. Yeah. There's actually such a school, no, that states that things, all things exist. And here all things means things in the past, things in the future, things in the present. And it's called Shravastivadin. Yeah. Shravastivadin. If you go into the commentaries, you'll find this term very common. Yeah, Shravastivadin, Mula Shravastivadin. No? So the fact that you are attending SGC, there's a high chance you attended the Heart Sutra, like our sister just now. What's her name? Where did she go to? Ah, Kya Kim. Yeah, Kya Kim. Right? Can you remember Kya Kim? The Heart Sutra, the teaching. Now it's time for you to have a revision. don't stress out because she ran away. Next week, don't turn up for class anymore. Yeah. But you are, most of you, I think, would have attended the some talks on the Heart Sutra and then the teaching on emptiness. Yeah. So emptiness is about nature. Do things have nature, meaning that it has some qualities that is inside. Yeah. That means this thing has certain quality in and by itself. Yeah. Does such a thing exist? Yeah? In terms of the inner quality. So recently I gave an explanation about how, for example, in the Heart Sutra, we talk about whether human is conditional or not. Yeah, we talk about that. Yeah, so just as a teaser. So, are you all human? Are all of you human? Say yes. Should be yes, huh? If no, you can see me after this, okay? Maybe we need to have some discussion and you can tell me which realm you are from. So the fact that we are human, we say that the fact that we are human, if it's a fact, then what is that to discuss, right? So there are multiple angles that I look at. So we typically just say, we are human. It's a foregone knowledge, is that's it, period. So during the class, we went through the discussion of how, from the Buddhist angle, first of all, the physical body of a human, we don't just exist by ourselves. We require our father-mother involvement. Yeah, either father-mother directly or the sperm and egg. Yeah, so if it's through artificial insemination, then you don't need the father direct involvement, yeah, but except the sperm, right? In future, maybe they can synthesize that, yeah. I think cloning is using that process, or they don't need further involvement of everybody. But barring that, yeah, our existence itself require conditions. So that's one angle. We are not inherently human, not inherently like this. Further, then from karma point of view, you need karmic condition to be reborn as a human. And then thirdly, I went through how human is a human concept. Yeah, can you remember? That if a fly or an ant, when an ant is crawling up our body, does it know that it's climbing up a human being? We may think that, no, maybe ant is too small, but dogs know. How do you know that the dog know you as a human? We don't know. I don't know, lah. At least I don't know. I don't know whether you know, but do you know that what you know is really what the dog know? You know what I mean? Right? But because for all human, we seem to perceive each other in the same way. So that seems to be the nature that we are all human. We have the human. We have some humanness. Yeah. The moment we open our eyes, we see, oh, human. I see a human here. I see a human there, and so on and so forth. But that's because we are human and we interpret it that way. It's quite crazy, yeah. Then that day I gave another example, which perhaps is less abstract. So for example, I presume your monitor is hard, yeah? And you should, if you move left or right a bit more, there should be some wall around you. Question, are walls inherently hard? Now you are wondering, is it hard? If you're not sure, very simple. You can just find out. Just go towards the wall and knock your head. Yeah, just knock your head. Try. Yeah, but just because it's hard now doesn't mean tomorrow will be hard. So every day you knock. Yeah. Until you get enlightened or you go crazy or you become stupid, then you don't ask this question anymore. As far as human beings are concerned, as far as the concrete wall is concerned, yeah, I'm not even going down the, oh, maybe some wall is not made of concrete. Let's just look at concrete, okay? Are concrete walls inherently hard? So this is where it becomes interesting. Because as far as human being is concerned, we haven't found any concrete wall where you can knock your head and then the concrete wall break, but your head don't break, right? Actually, I did knock into a wall before, you know. I was in a Buddhist library and Bhante was at the third floor and I was going out for a talk. So I came out and I saw him with the volunteers and then I greeted him, talked to him a bit, and as I was going off in somewhat a bit of a rush, so I, after talking, I just turned around And there was a pillar. And I knocked myself into the wall. And it was so loud. You know how loud it is? When I turned around, this is how Bhante looked like. Bhante Dharmaratna. He said, I've never seen him look so shocked before. He's like, he was speechless there. And all the few volunteers are like, Sufu, are you okay? And I'm like, I'm okay. And when I hit the wall, I saw something drop off. There's a chip, one piece of the wall, of the concrete, of the pillar came off. So if you have a chance, usually visitors cannot go to the third floor because third floor is where the volunteers are. But if you have a chance to go to the third floor, when you open the door into the common area, the first pillar on the right, nearest to the door, yeah, and you try to find around 1.75 meter, because that's where, you know, 1.8 is here, so maybe 1.75 meters you measure, you should see a chip. Oh, Sifu, so you prove that wall is not inherently hard. Your head is harder than the wall. No, that's not the proof. The point is, as far as human beings are concerned, with human beings as a condition, the wall is hard. The wall is not by itself hard. That's why you can tear down the wall with an excavator. If the wall is inherently hard, nothing can break it. It's as simple as that. But it doesn't end there. That day's discussion goes further to highlight that. But because, as far as human beings is concerned, although we also see construction workers, you know, break down walls, they use the steel ball, bang, you know, and then the wall just, and sometimes you see some videos. Okay, don't ask me why I watch videos of construction workers demolishing walls, okay? Yeah, but I've seen, and it's quite long. And you see them, it's quite amazing. They stand on the ledge of the wall, and they are demolishing the very wall they are standing on without safety guidelines or anything. It's mind-blowing. The point is, despite us witnessing all this, we tend to draw the wrong conclusion that walls are inherently hard. Because with respect to us, they are hard. Now, what does this mean? This means that we have a tendency to draw the wrong conclusion about things having inherentness. That whether the wall is hard or not, perhaps it's less material, right? Unless you have a tendency to knock in the walls like myself. But if you apply this principle into how we look at people, then you may start to think further. How often do we look at someone and then form a first impression or pass a judgment and think that the person is inherently like this or like that, right? And when someone tells you that, no, it's just your impression, your first impression only, we may even further feel that, no, Shifu, that person is always like that, right? I'm telling you this because I experienced this myself. So the trouble is this. Within our lifetime, our interaction with certain individuals may oftentimes result in the same experience. You know, hey, but Sifu, I thought you said that things are not inherent. Yes, they are not inherent. Doesn't mean they will change, you know. As long as the conditions fall within a certain band, your experience is more or less the same, number one. Number two, in addition to that, our preconception colors how we interpret things, how we perceive things. So that further cements how the person appears to us. And even if we remove the latter, that means remove our coloring. If your conditions with that person, that means our yin yuan, the mutual condition is more or less still the same, then you are in all likelihood going to experience the same person, The same irritating person, the same interesting person, the same whatever person. And as a result, then we tend to draw the conclusion that the person is inherently like this or like that, when still not inherent. Can you see this? If you still cannot see, sign up for the next Heart Sutra class. So this theme on whether things are inherent or not is explored in many angle, from many point of view, within Abhidhamma also, but not necessarily in that detail or in the same way inside the Theravada one. Here I'm going beyond Theravada Abhidhamma. Okay, in like Sarvastivada Abhidhamma and so on, they have commentaries on such topics. Yeah, because they are. Do not think that all schools purport that things have no inherentness. There are some schools that states that no, there is inherentness. Very interesting. Besides that, then there are other themes regarding how things come about. Conditionality. Yeah. And here, conditionality is not simply linked to emptiness again, okay? Yeah, talking about the various conditions required. So they talk about 六种因，五种果，四种缘. Yeah, the six causes, the five fruits, and four conditions. And different schools have slightly different terms or definition of them. Then temporality, just now I mentioned about it already, yeah, past, future, present. Then about rebirth and identity. So these are themes that you find in normal Dharma talks we also talk about, right? But in the Abhidhamma, then there's further questions about this. Yeah, and these are common questions actually. Questions like, hey, Sifu, in Buddhism we teach no self, right? Then if there's no self, then how do you have rebirth? Right? So if you consider all this, then you realize that Abhidhamma is not so foreign. And the impression sometimes we get about Abhidhamma is, well, Abhidhamma is some very, well, because, you know, it's a higher text, it's a superior text. So as though it's some master's degree course, university, like, you know, PhD level, then you can study that. But actually, it's about the very questions we have, isn't it? Yeah. Except that when we have those questions, it's maybe not so formally established, not very formalized. Yeah. And maybe we only thought about one part, but the various Abhidhamma texts look at it from so many other angles. So these are interesting for us, not just as a point of curiosity, but helpful for us to explore, to learn, because then it can help us to, when we revisit the teachings, such as the Eightfold Path, the Four Noble Truths, it can help us to relook at it and say, hey, how does it map together? Yeah. When we learn no self, what's the point of no self? When I first learned about the teaching of no self, it was simply as the three universal characteristics. Yeah, anicca, dukkha, anatta, memorize. Yeah. For me, a lot of Buddhisms, I didn't really try to memorize them. The only thing I had to memorize was the Heart Sutra. And it was because there was this Taiwanese instructor who helped to conduct the Dharma camp for NTU Buddhist Society, and a whole bunch of us, like majority of us, couldn't memorize it, you know. And you know what she told us on the second day of the don't know, first or second day I think, of the Dharma camp, that was way back on. She said, 我在台湾主办儿童佛学营，那个小朋友第一天就把心经背完了。 他们都是小学生，你们是南洋理工大学的大学生。 应该没有问题吧？哇，all of us，哇，马路 man，so，哇，force myself，开玩笑啊，what 小学生啊，primary school kids can memorize 啊，you tell me Taiwanese primary school kids can memorize this，Heart Sutra，然后 she keep on highlighting，心经是最短的了。260个字应该不是问题。哇 memorize not so many pages, just one, how to try just one page, no? 哇，这不一空空，哇，那空空的来乱尿。But after a few days, I think a good number of us managed to memorize it. Yeah. But the rest of the terms, somehow, over time, I just it just it was just quite easy for me to remember them. Yeah. My point is this, that initially because partly because it's quite easy for me to remember them, so I didn't really, maybe it's because at the earlier years, I didn't really think much about so no self, what does it mean, you know, anatta, okay. Of course, you know, all the books explain to you, right? But I never really sit down and think, so what, you know, what is the implication? And why must it be no self? At first place, what, you know, all these questions. But over the years, then I start to appreciate a bit more. Yeah. And today, the other day I just mentioned, one, there are two approaches that I find useful for people. So in terms of self or no self, one angle is assume that there is no self. Another angle is don't assume that it is no self. So when you are trying out the teachings, just assume there is no self. What does it mean? It means if you encounter some situation and then ask yourself, if truly what the Buddha said is true, that there's no fixed identity, there's no permanent persona, then how would I look at this situation? But this is kind of like borrowing the Buddha's wisdom and then see, okay, so what, you know? But if you are investigating and trying to contemplate on no self, you cannot start off with the assumption that it is no self. If you start off with no self, then what is that called? No self, no self. Okay, thank you very much. 3 second contemplation. Yeah. So that's where, then if you want to contemplate on no self, then you must start off not assuming it's no self, but to go and examine what is self. Yeah. So part of this approach, of course, my teacher, Sang Miao Xia Jing Lao Hosang, my ordination teacher, he went through at length. But I recall as well from another senior monk, Guo Hua Fa Si. So when I was in Taiwan, while I prepared for my ordination, and then later on, 1 year later, when I was preparing for higher ordination, I stayed in San De Si. And during that period, he would talk to me, ask me questions, and then have Dhamma discussions with me. Yeah. So one of the themes that came up was the thing on no self. Yeah, and he passed me a set of notes regarding what is self. Yeah, and the same thing, actually, of course, he learned under my teacher before. So later on, when I went back, so I listened to my teacher's teaching. Yeah, my teacher always highlight, 什么是我? What is self? Yeah, the three features of self. Yeah, 常恒住不变异有主宰, yeah, or 主宰性. Yeah, three features. 常恒住, eternal, yeah, 不变异, unchanging, not changing, 有主宰, autonomous. Yeah, that means you can decide just independently on your own. Yeah, without any, that means not just make decisions, but you can decide how you. So let's say this is the self. The self can decide how it wants to be. Yeah? Self. Okay. Let's like to have some funny props. Self. If this is a self, then self can decide how self want to be. So And later on, when you look through the Pali Canon, right, then you realize actually this is exactly the questions that Buddha asked, you know, that if physical form is self, then you should be able to decide how the physical form is to be in future. Then you can decide that the physical body not go through aging, sickness, or death, right? But it is still subject to aging, sickness, and death. You cannot control it. Can you determine whether it goes through aging, sickness, and death? SK2 doesn't count. I think at some point, SK2 is going to send me a letter, you know. Maybe they will send me a sample. Dear Venerable, we have heard from sources that you have repeatedly refuted the progress of SK2 to defeat aging. So we have sent you a whole hamper pack. Yeah, every month we'll send you one pack for you to peruse, to experience the youth rejuvenating qualities of SK2. Yeah, but I will tell you this. The very fact that there's SK2 is evidence of the fact that the body is not within our control. That's why we need SK2 to control it, to try to influence it. And even then, still cannot. Yeah, still cannot. Only limited control for our time being. Beyond that, lao to si lao liao. Yeah. You see some, wow, the skin super smooth, but then the eyes look old. Yeah, you know, our eyes tell our age. So, oh, wow, super, then the eyes. So that's actually a very scary one. Have you ever seen before? Yeah, the wow, everything looks so young. Black hair, wow, it's very nice. Then the eyes look old. Yeah, but anyway, that's our struggle. That's our struggle. Yeah. So the Buddhist approach is very interesting. Looking at self. And not just physical body, our mind as well. And mind, then they break down into feelings, perception, mental formations, and consciousness, right? And even if you look at the classical teaching in the Pali Canon, right? Mind is only just this four, right? Yeah. Much lesser compared to Abhidhamma. Yeah. But even these four, I sometimes tell students, these four on a daily basis, do you think of yourself, think of others in terms of these four? Strictly speaking, not in this way, isn't it? Yeah. We may use similar terms like conscious, yeah, but not exactly in the same way as this, right? The way it's found in the sutras. So my point is not that we should throw away the sutras, no. These terms are very useful, but to realize that in our day-to-day usage, we need to sort of do a mapping to our own experiences. And in this way, then we can make the teachings come to life, yeah, for us. The last theme that I want to talk about is the atomism. Qi Wei, Chinese called Qi Wei. We have another term called infinismal. Oh, very cheap term. Even for me, it's cheap. We were doing translation, then we're like, hey, atomic. Then initially, we used the word atomic, I think. Then after, we're like, hey, but atomic, from science, we know that atom is not the smallest. Eh? Yeah, because there's proton, neutron inside the atom. And then proton, neutron can be broken down further into quarks, and then quarks broken down into something else, particles. But more importantly, we change from atoms to infinitesimal because Jiwei has that meaning. Infinitesimal has that meaning of Ji and Wei. Wei, Ji means very extreme, then Wei means very subtle, very small. So infinitesimal, infinite simal, so extremely small. Yeah, so in the Abhidhamma text, various schools also have this concept that the physical world can be broken down into tiny particles. Yeah, that these small particles is the building blocks. So this is very interesting because the word atom found in the Greek philosophy, Aristotle, yeah, they have this notion also, atomos, yeah, that the physical world comprises indestructible element. Yeah, atomos has that notion that it's indivisible. Yeah. So although different country, different kind of backdrop, but they seem to go towards a certain angle, which is similar. Yeah. So, but from this, then there are a lot of question marks, a lot more other question marks. So, in the I think in the Yogacara school, we also talk about this jiwei thing. Yeah, that's mentioned about this jiwei. In the Ru Pusa Singlun, the Bodhicharya Vatara commentary from the Tibetan tradition, yeah, then they have the argument, not argument, they have the debate with other schools that says there is infinitesimal. Yeah, so they question each other. You see, there's infinitesimal. So is your infinitesimal, does it have sides or parts? Can it come, when it touch each other, do they touch as a whole? So you think about it, you say infinitesimal has no parts and it has no sides. So if it has no sides and no parts, then do they touch each other? If they touch each other, do they touch completely or partially? If partially, that means your earlier statement is wrong. If completely, then are they one or are they separate? It's mind-twisting. Yeah, but it's very logical. The series of questions in the Abhidhamma are all very interesting and very logical. Yeah. So beyond that, let me see. So when Dharma talk until cannot talk already, so show. So this one is the Visuddhi Magga. Yeah, so talk about the path of purification. It loosely follows seven stages that can be found in the Pali Canon. The Sutta on the seven chariots, seven chariots, starting from Sila, Samadhi, and then wisdom and views, and so on and so forth. So this one by Venerable Buddha Gosa, reprinted courtesy of the corporate body of the Buddha Education Foundation, yeah, in Taiwan. Yeah, they do free printing of various Buddhist texts. Our translation, we send it to them for free printing also. But the new translations, we stopped sending to them, not because they did a bad job, they did an excellent job. Well, because over the years, we realized that most people don't carry books nowadays. And when you get them to reprint, they actually have to find a means to... Printing is just half the problem. It's how to keep the books, you know, in a good condition so that when people order, and when they retrieve from the store, they are still in a good condition and not all yellow and torn, you know. Yeah. So this one is from the Tibetan tradition on emptiness. Yeah. Emptiness in the mind-only school of Buddhism. A few names. So just now mentioned Venerable Buddha Gosa, right? Then you have Vasubandhu. No, Vasubandhu. Yeah, and we have Venerable Asanga. So they are under the consciousness only school. Venerable Nagarjuna is under the he's reputed to have established the emptiness only school, or emptiness school, not emptiness only. Then you have that Theravada Abhidharma. Then you have the Shravastivada Abhidharma. A good number of these books are actually from Sister Ming. Yeah, she very kindly. Come and think about it. Some were gifted to me. Some, I don't know whether it was lent to me, but somehow become permanently lent. She didn't ask that. I thought, well, if she needs, she will ask for me. Maybe I should check with her. Yeah. But I know that some of it were given to me. Like I think this one, yeah, this one has a note. So this one is quite clearly given to me. Now, this Shravastivada Abhidharma is written by the Fa Guang Fa Shi. This one is different from the one who is known in Singapore. This one is, I believe he is the one who teaches in Hong Kong. Yeah, who teaches in Hong Kong. But there are a lot of other books lah. Oh. So the whole shelf, I cannot be bringing the whole shelf down. So, 2 more minutes left. Well, I thought today I will finish at 3 o'clock. Abhidharma is a very interesting journey for myself. I must also do a proper declaration. I cannot say that I'm definitely not an expert in Abhidharma. No. Theravada Abhidharma, I read through the compendium and some of the texts way back in the US. A good part of the Chinese texts that I go through under my teacher falls under Abhidharma directly. Yeah, but still, I don't say that I am actually qualified to fully teach the whole Abhidharma also. This sounds cliche, but the more I learn, the more I feel that I'm not qualified. Yeah, I think one day I will tell you all, I cannot teach. I better keep my mouth shut. Yeah. So, do you all have any questions to ask? Anybody have any questions to ask? You can also send me a text if you all have any questions to ask. I hope today's session serve as a primer. Or as I mentioned, it's meant to be a level 100. So it's more like an introduction. I hope it piqued your interest and curiosity about what Abhidharma is. If you leave this session with more questions than answer, then I've done my job. And I hope that you all will go and attend classes on Abhidharma elsewhere. Don't ask me to start Abhidharma classes. I know. If I don't say that later on after this, there'll be students saying, "Hey, so Sifu, that day I attended the SGC on Abhidharma. Hey, so when are you going to start? Let me just tell you all first, okay? Before you all send me text, call me and tell me or whatever. Currently, I'm waiting to clear Wednesday Diamond Sutra, Thursday, the Ruposa Singlun, Buddhicharya Vatara. Okay, so these two are long-running classes. Wednesday class may take another few months, at least a few more months. Thursday class is wrapping up because we are doing the rereading. No? But I have a few backlog. Yeah, I have a few backlog. Like Ta Pei Zhou, I did once, and then after that, Vicky asked me a few times, "So, Sifu, are you going to do it again?" Then I'm like, Ta Pei Zhou quite long also. We did over like what, 9 months, 6 months or something, like two sessions, and it was very rushed. I'm like, what's that? And then there's also the Huayanjing that I still owe some students and Bante. Also, this one, we can do a rerun, but the earliest possible will be next year, if I'm still alive. Okay. So with that, I want to take the opportunity. Just now, Alvin was texting me about the, he sent me a video. I didn't click and watch, but from the description, he mentioned about this young girl who broke down during the interview. I don't think I need to watch it to appreciate that the devastation, the trauma, the tragedy that is happening. It